Coming up on this week's show, an amazing new mech game for the Spectrum.
Jennifer Lopez releases a retro game.
And we get stories from Probe and Acclaim with the legendary Joe Bonner.
The Retro Owl podcast is brought to you each week with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, we're going to tell you more about their incredible Sega Master System, a visual compendium book covering 200 of the best games on the platform, over 424 pages. Keep listening for more on that and check out their full range of retro books at bitmapbooks.co.uk. Hello and welcome to the Retro Owl podcast, episode number 297, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show that takes you back to the good old days of video games, talking about systems like the Super Nintendo, the Mega Drive, the Amiga, the Atari ST. Name a few classic consoles, Joe.
Nintendo, Mega Drive, SNES, Atari Jaguar, the Lynx. There you go.
Keep going.
Keep going. Jesus. The Master 3DO. System. The 3DO. The Philips CDI.
The you Magnavox name it, Odyssey.
We cover it. The Magnavox Odyssey. You name it, we cover it.
That is a thing. We've done almost 300 episodes, weekly episodes of this podcast now. And we are planning a bit of a celebration for our 300th episode that we'll tell you more about in just a bit. But that is the sheer breadth of things that we've covered on the podcast over almost 6 years of doing it now. All those systems that we mentioned and lots more as well. And every week on the show, we bring you an amazing guest as well. Now, this week, I'm really excited to hear some stories about, I mean, Probe and Acclaim. They were two companies, you know, as a kid who had an Amiga at home, and being able to play some of their pretty much arcade perfect ports. I mean, I remember playing Golden Axe, you know, and I love that game in the arcades, and the Amiga version was very impressive. And I love Mortal Kombat as well on the Amiga when that came out in the arcade. I was addicted to that and being able to play it at home as well. Thanks to Probe and Acclaim, I mean, they were incredible companies back then. And you're going to be joined this week. You guys have done this interview with a guy who worked very closely inside these companies and actually did a lot of those ports that we played as kids.
Yeah, this is an absolutely amazing interview. So I reached out to Joe Bonner, and he's basically a legend. He's worked for 34 years in the video game industry, and he started, you know, in England, and he was doing his Spectrum stuff. He worked with Telecom Soft, so he was involved with North and South. Absolutely amazing C64 titles, and, you know, all the different brands there where they had Firebird, Raybird and Silverbird, and then he was working porting stuff with Probe as well. So, you know, Probe were porting stuff for every system out there, and they were doing like the really good ports of like Golden Axe and stuff, and Alien 3, and
there's love that game.
So many titles that we talk about, isn't there, Joe?
Yeah, we kind of ran out of time with this one. You know, when Ravi first got a hold of him, we were like, you know, We could interview this guy for hours. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, if you say so. And we jumped on it. And this happens, I say this so many times, especially when I'm involved in interviews, but I say this so many times, like, these people, they've got so much to tell us and, you know, archive, essentially. Mm. And I hate it sometimes. I love it and I hate it because it's like, we talked about Alien 3. We talked about Alien Trilogy.
We talked about the N-Gage.
We talked about the N-Gage, but we only get to talk about these things for like 5 minutes, you know. It's really, really, really cool. So much history there with Joe Bonner, and hopefully we'll have him on again soon just to go a little bit more in depth. You know, while we were talking, he was like, oh yeah, when I worked on Mortal Kombat, and me and Ravi like scrambling to talk about Mortal Kombat then. You know, so I'm giving a lot away, but this guy worked on a lot of games, a lot of ports, and some really funny stories behind them as well.
Yeah, really, really funny stuff as well. Stuff about C64 scene as well, you know, demo coding, stuff like that. Working with EA as well, and just the way that stuff were ported, Silicon Graphics, just so much in this interview. And this is the first time he's ever done an interview, and I think this is like one of our best, and I really enjoyed doing it with Joe, so it's going to be a complete treat for Dan to listen to.
Yeah, can't wait for this one. Like I said, all those games you covered there, I mean, I grew up playing all those games. Alien 3 on the Amiga, that was incredible. So looking forward to hearing these stories. Joe Bonner is coming up on the show in around 25 minutes from now. I hope I'm standing all right this week, because I am doing this week's podcast, the first one from my shiny new home studio that just got built last week. waiting for that.
Last week. No, for ages.
No dogs.
Finally was ready to move into, yeah. That's the thing because, I mean, I do a lot of like audio production that, you know, obviously since COVID hit, I mean, we've been doing this podcast remotely. I do, you know, some people know that I do DJ live streams as well. I've been doing my DJ streams from our living room table, you know, which obviously the wife hasn't been too happy about for like the last 18 months. We've been doing the podcast, now been in my home office, hear the dog barking in the background, the traffic and everything. So I thought it was about time I actually converted my garage into a proper studio now. And originally, because I mean, I've got the podcast gear in here, I've got my decks opposite me as well, all the sound paneling on the wall and everything. I thought, right, well, this is going to be my working room. It's not going to be like my office where I'm surrounded by my Mega Drive and everything's out there as well. I've been in here, I'd say, probably about 3 days now. To the left of me, Amiga 1200 and a CRT.
I knew that'd slip in. You can't keep it as like a clean environment. You've got to get your machines in there and suddenly you're sitting there working going, ooh, maybe 5 minutes playing a little game on that.
You know what, Ravi? I was meant to be doing stuff for work this afternoon and I thought, I'm trying to get that Amiga 1200 online via Wi-Fi. I think I spent about 2.5 hours doing that instead of working this afternoon, so... A little bit dangerous, but now I'm thinking I've got room there for my Mega Drive. And actually, I've got those IKEA cubes. I could put my SNES in that one. My N64 will go quite nicely there. All I need is a toilet in here. I never have to go in the house.
and a little mini fridge.
Oh, there's an idea. I'm going to get an Amazon after this, I think. But actually, you boys haven't been in here yet, but you are going to be. First time we're doing a show in person again in a couple of weeks' time.
What,
because
for like 2 years.
It will much. Be, yeah. Yeah. Nearly 2 years since we last.
It's going to be scary looking into your eyes and actually seeing it.
My dark soul. Well, that's the least scary thing about episode 300, because for the first time ever, we are going to be doing a live episode of the Retro Hour podcast. Warts and all.
I'm just not going to talk on that episode because I am terrified. But yeah, episode 300, we're trying something different, aren't we?
Well, yeah, I think what we're going to do is we're going to bring you video mainly because, you know, that's an aspect that people have wanted to see. And we've not been together, so we've not been able to do it at home. And what we're going to do is we're going to have a camera set up and we're going to stream to the patrons. And then afterwards, we're going to release like a full video of the whole show that's actually slickly cut up. And, you know, it will be like the standard podcast release, but a 300 special in video form with special guests and stuff like that. Oh, it does sound fun, actually. And Dan's going to have a great time editing that in his new office.
Can't wait. I mean, you know, we've got Handsome Joe on the podcast. It'd be, you know, a waste of his looks if we didn't do a video for it, wouldn't it? Let's be honest.
Throw me under the bus.
You don't have to say anything, Joe. Just sit there and look handsome. That's your job. Yeah, but I mean, there are more details coming up over the next couple of weeks of who's going to be involved in it. We've got a few good friends of the show that are going to be on as well. We're hoping to get a lot of you guys on the episode too. And like I said, our patrons can actually watch it being recorded live and see, you know, how slick this show is, how we never get anything wrong and we never mess up or anything,
never,
do we?
It's,
you know, yeah, exactly. So we'll tell you more about that as we get close to it. We're going to be recording that on October 31st, we think Halloween. So more on that coming up very soon. But of course, lots of news stories to get through. Before we do, though, let's give a massive thank you to one of our favourite supporters of the Retro Hour podcast. And this is something everybody should be reading, Retro Gamer Magazine. Now, we've said it before, us guys, religious readers of Retro Gamer Mag. And this month, actually, there's so much in the current issue. It's actually their 20th anniversary celebration of one of your favourite games, Ravi. You're a huge fan of Super Monkey Ball.
Oh, yeah. I love the mini games in Super Monkey Ball. So there's a whole like section of mini games that you can do. And there's this one where you have to kind of parachute and land on this island. And I play that for days with my friends. And, you know, it was a really cool, innovative game, actually. And like, whoever came up with that concept of a monkey inside a ball, it's surprisingly addictive. And it's cool to see that that's the kind of main headline on this issue.
Yeah, it's a massive feature all about it. And also some of Joe will be really interested in. Looking here, there's about six pages all about the Mega CD, a collector's guide that they do, which, yeah, I mean, there are some games on there. I mean, if you want to get a copy of Road Avenger for the Mega CD, how much do you think you pay for that, Joe?
Road Avenger, about £10.
£250.
No.
What about Snatcher?
Snatcher, now I know that sets you back about £300-£400, doesn't it?
No, £900.
I need to get this magazine, clearly.
You need this month's issue. But it is available now, and there's a lot more in there as well. They're making a theme park, Chucky Egg, the ultimate guide, where they go in depth into the making of that. They've got Mortal Kombat 2 in here, feature on the Sega Nomad. Lots in every month's issue, packed of retro gaming goodness. And of course, we get you some amazing offers. Now, at the moment, if you subscribe using our special link, you will get a free N64 Tribute or a Mega Drive Bluetooth controller. Now, we were kind of fawning over the N64 Tribute one on last week's show. That Mega Drive one looks beautiful as well. It's kind of like it's a six-button Bluetooth Mega Drive controller, isn't it? Which was always my favourite, actually, the Mega Drive controllers.
Yeah, the six-button one is like the way you need to go, especially if you're playing with Mega. Like, when you go back and play Mega Drive now, like, it's really hard to play on the three button, so you've got to get the six-button one for sure.
And this works with their Windows, Mac, Raspberry Pi, iOS, Switch as well, and the Tribute 64 controller, which is kind of like what you said last week, what we all wished the N64 controller was actually like back in the day. A more comfortable looking one, available in USB, or actually, it's got a classic N64 port on it as well for use on your original console. So both of them perfect for, you know, emulation or using on, you know, for example, the N64 games that are on the Switch online. So have a look right now on this link and support the podcast by doing it. Subscribe to Retro Gamer, treat yourself, and choose your free retro controller on us. All you have to do is head to magazinesdirect.com/retropod. And if you already subscribed to Retro Gamer, you know, Christmas coming up in a couple of months' time, you could gift the mag to someone else. Keep the gift for yourself, you know, get something out of it too. And you can get 6 months of Retro Gamer with a retro controller absolutely free. Use our link and support the show, magazinesdirect.com/retropod. And a massive thank you to our good mates at Retro Gamer for their support of the podcast. Now, it seems that Arcade 1UP just come out with incredible new home arcade cabinets pretty much every other month at the moment. This one, I must admit, I was particularly hyped for because you guys know how much I love Ridge Racer.
Yeah, they've announced this week the Ridge Racer Arcade 1UP three-quarter machine and the Tron machine as well, which is really interesting. What I find quite interesting about the Ridge Racer one is when I was reading the article, I was like, I'm sure Ridge Racer had a sit-down machine, wasn't it? I'm sure it was a sit-down.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
Whereas this is an upright arcade machine with the pedals at the bottom to kind of make it, you know, fit in your man cave, I assume. Even though they have done sit-down cabinets before, haven't they? Arcade 1UP, but
I think there was two versions of Ridge Racer back in the day. There was a full sit-down cabinet and just a stand-up one with a wheel, yeah.
Oh, fair enough. But yeah, this has got you written all over it, Dan, this Ridge Racer one, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's what I used to play at my local bowling alley and nagging my dad for, like, I think it was about £2 to play in it back in, like, 1994, 95 when it came out. Massive. One of my, you know, my favourite racing game, actually. And being able to play the arcade version at home on an actual cabinet with a wheel. That's what I love about it. I mean, you know, a lot of these kind of home arcade cabinets are just kind of, they put a joystick on there or they have, like, a standard kind of look, you know, you run emulation. But actually having the wheel, which is by far the best way to play racing games. But also Tron as well. I mean, I don't know if you guys, are you guys a fan of the Tron movies?
The movies, definitely, yeah.
You know what? I've not seen the sequel, you know, the 2010 one, Tron Legacy. Yeah. And so many people are going to be so annoyed now. But I tried to watch the original Tron a couple of years ago and I really struggled. Like, and it came off because I was watching it with my wife and she was like huffing and puffing the whole time we were watching it. But I am more than familiar with Tron and the, you know, the games that come with it and stuff like that. So, you know, finding it difficult to get excited about the Tron one, but I can imagine a lot of people.
Well, it's like, it's got the two games as well. So it's Tron and Discs of Tron as well. So that's pretty good that they've got both in there. But quickly just going back to the Ridge Racer one, one thing I want to mention is I noticed that they've got like little risers on them and stuff. How does it work with the pedals? Because in the promo shot, they're doing the knee bend kind of thing, which, you know, they're never really standing up straight in these 1UP arcade ones. And I wonder, can you use a riser on this with
it
pedals?
Looks like in the picture they are already on the risers, to be perfectly honest. The picture to me, because they're only three-quarter size, as you mentioned, and then you can buy the risers. I think a lot of the arcade 1UPs come with the risers now because, you know, they're one of those companies that do actually listen to their fans. And it looks like to me that it has got the riser and that the pedals are compatible with it. But I've read the whole article because I was the same as you, Ravi. I was like, how's that going to work? And it doesn't mention it, but in the picture, obviously this is just my speculation, it looks like it is already on it. And obviously,
yeah, maybe you can pump that up, or you can add a little bit in between there or something.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe there's some cables in there which will attach easily, you know, kind of like Lego.
or they're encouraging you to sit on a stool and
yeah, maybe
drive like that.
Well, I don't know. You won't be able to because of the pedals. Unless, you know, you've got your missus doing that with her hands for you.
Put the kids to work doing the pedals
for you. Put the kids to work or something. But yeah, I'm not too sure that how that one's going to work. But the Tron one is going to be available from next week, the 19th of October, for pre-order. But Dan, you'll have to wait a little bit longer for the Ridge Racer one. Pre-orders are going up November 22nd for that one.
Just in time for Christmas. Yeah. I mean, these are normally a few hundred dollars. Have we got pricing on these?
We've not got pricing at the moment. But
yeah,
as you say, you know, they always come out in America first, and then they tend to be available through like Very and Smiths in the UK.
Yeah.
But like I was thinking, I was thinking with that Tron one, there's so much UV light in there, you could probably retrobrite something if you put it on the Tron cabinet and covered it in tin foil. It might work well.
Double use then, isn't it? You're getting your value for like your 400-500 quid, whatever it's going to cost. So I mean, I think that looks incredible. Now I'm in my new studio and I'm thinking, you know, I've got a space in the corner.
You might get away with it now.
Okay, go. Oh, it's got to be done. Got to be done, I think. So if you want to find out more about that, I'll link it up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Are you guys fans of Mech Wars games? I've always quite liked mech games.
I've not really played many, actually. I played an Amiga VR, a virtuality machine mech game. Mm. And that was pretty interesting, but I did kind of feel a bit ill and sick after playing that for a while. But it's usually two controllers, isn't it? And I've never really got into them at the arcades and stuff like that.
Yeah, I quite like this game called Iron Soldier that I love on the Jaguar. One of the best Atari Jaguar games where you play as a big mech. It feels like, you know, it's really a powerful big mech that you're in. You can do a lot of destruction as well. Generally, they are, you know, games that you tend to see more in 3D over the last couple of decades. But actually, I didn't expect to see this. A Mech Wars arena game that is coming to the ZX Spectrum. Now, this looks really impressive. There's a little trailer on YouTube that I'll link up in our show notes. And actually, when you look at it at the start, this is something that you don't normally see in Spectrum games, or really many 8-bit games. It's actually got like a full story with cutscenes at the beginning of the game, kind of taking you through the backstory of the game. I mean, back in the day when you got a Spectrum game, you generally would get the story in the manual.
Yeah.
And you'd have to kind of read that if you, you know, bothered, which most people didn't, before you played the game. But this has actually got pretty much a 2 or 3 minute introduction story before you get into the game.
I'm not gonna lie, I was just flicking through the video then and I was really impressed with the story, and then I got to the gameplay and remembered it's on the ZX Spectrum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a Spectrum game. It's 2D, it's overhead. I mean, you're not gonna get, you know, some
but they've got like destructible landscapes and stuff, and many sprites on the screen at the same time. You know, it does look for a specy game quite advanced.
Well, there's gonna be stuff like there's a deathmatch mode in there as well, so you can have two players playing, which, you know, is very cool for this kind of game. There's capture the flag mode as well. So it looks like, I mean, you know, if you want a good 8-bit mech game, this looks quite advanced for a Spectrum game, I think. And they're going to be releasing it, by the looks of it, on if you go to ZXBittles.com, there's a page on there as well. It looks like they actually do quite a lot of physical releases, you know, actually on Spectrum cassettes.
I was wondering, would Walker then count as a mech game?
Yeah, yeah. I class that as like a side-scrolling mech game. So yeah, I do think it looks very, very cool. I mean, not the kind of game you normally see on the Spectrum.
Yeah,
yeah. It does. It does look quite different, and it's like you say, there is like the destructible walls and stuff like that in there. But I think, you know, for me, I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, it's not. I was more, like I say, I was more impressed with the story. But the more I watch it, it's like, yeah, this is running on the Spectrum at the end of the day. So it is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and actually, if you go on their website as well, obviously I'll link that up, they actually go quite in depth into kind of the development phase of it as well. So you can kind of see, they've been doing this now since the start of June.
Okay.
So you can kind of go back over the last few months and see what they've been doing and kind of the progress and how they've made the game. Bit of a backstory on it as well. And if you want to support them, we haven't got a release date on it yet, but it looks like it's pretty far along, actually. So we'll keep an eye on that, and I'll link it up if you want to follow its progress. Nice to see new titles for the Spectrum. Now, a lot of the time we talk about new retro-inspired titles that come out on modern consoles. And this is quite an interesting article. It's by a guy called Noah Pantano on an entertainment website called scbr.com. And the article is titled 10 Things That Modern Retro Games Get Wrong About the Era That They're Imitating. Now, he argues that retro is not a style, but actually retro games had a completely different kind of game theory behind them. It kind of goes way beyond just having kind of pixelated graphics, for example. So that's kind of his first point. I mean, we'll quickly run through a few of his main points here. I thought it might be quite interesting to kind of get your guys' thoughts on this. He kind of argues that a lot of people, when they are making a retro game, he said retro is not just a look. So he said, if you know, most people want to make a retro title, they'll make it kind of an 8 or 16-bit pixelated game. But he's talking about stuff like games like Myst, that is now definitely a retro game, being, you know, almost 30 years old, that have beautiful rendered 3D graphics as well. So he's saying, you know, it's not just about pixels if you want to make a retro title.
It's an interesting point. I read the article earlier on, and some of it is, you know, I completely disagree with it, but, you know, some of it, I was a little bit like, I'm sure I'll agree with more of this when, you know, Dan kind of mentions it. And you know what, like, you are right. Like, my mind straight away, whenever you say, like, oh yeah, it's like a retro title, you know, it's on Xbox One, and, you know, arcade, and, you know what I mean, Xbox Live, and it's like a retro title, I instantly go to that, like, 16-bit pixelated artwork, or, you know, 32-bit kind of like 2D fighter, kind of, you know, Street Fighter and stuff like that. I instantly think of that, whereas you're right, you know, games, you know, I think of Doom, you know, like Doom kind of clones that still get made and stuff like that. But yeah, like, those 3D kind of rendered graphics, you know, or, you know, pre-rendered style, like, you know, like Myst and Resident Evil and stuff like that. Yeah, you, absolutely. These games are 30 years old, 25 years old, you know.
And Myst still looks stunning, I think.
Yeah, it does. It looks beautiful. And it's like, you are, the article is right, you're right. It doesn't have to straight away go to pixelated graphics. It isn't just a look.
Would you like to see more games in that kind of vein then, the early kind of 3D stuff? So, I mean, we talked about, obviously, recently, we did a whole episode about the kind of remaster of Quake. Which, you know, that kind of era does seem like it's kind of getting explored a bit more now than just kind of the 8-bit era.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, with the passage of time, that might just be why that is happening. And I think, you know, we might see more kind of games like that. You know, I for one, would definitely, I love, absolutely adore, as many people may know, classic Resident Evil games. And I always think to myself, I wish Resident Evil, you know, Capcom would just put some out like that, or remaster some of them. So yes, you know, my answer is, you know, I would like to see more like that.
You know what a lovely game is? Little Big Adventure. And the kind of renders on that, and the style of that, I really miss that kind of early weird 3D kind of crossover period with just, you know, round faces and stuff.
Is that like a
point
and click game?
Yeah, really.
Yeah, I do remember
PC it. And Little Big Adventure 2 as well. Great games.
Yeah, I think there, it is right. I mean, yeah, it, generally most people kind of go to, yeah, look, let's make it look like an NES game. But I think there probably is a bit more of a later era that they can explore now. His next point is, harder does not necessarily equal better. Now, he's talking about how back in the day, you know, you guys probably find the same. If you go back and play an old game that you haven't played for many years, often I get my ass handed to me because it is really difficult. But back then, as he mentions in the article, they only had like a megabyte or two of space. They didn't have, you know, ways to kind of make the games very long, so they made them really hard.
Every game was hard for us, Dan, because we were Amiga users, and they always set them to really hard standards, Amiga games.
Well, even if we go back and play 8-bit games and stuff, I always find them really difficult because if they were easy, you know, if you play a cheat mode or something, you can generally fire through a lot of those games in like 10, 15 minutes.
Well, I found that. I found that new retro games, you know, when they make them in a retro style, they make it, they're babying you through it, and they're holding your hand and taking you all the way through, where these old ones obviously didn't do that. It was, you know, like timing on jumps and stuff like that. So yeah, you're right. They were trickier, definitely.
Well, his next point is saves. It kind of follows on from that. Saves were invented for a reason. So he's saying, you know, that they shouldn't be making games hard just for the sake of it without save games in there, because nobody wants to be stuck on the first level of a game these days. Kind of going against the title of the article, actually, when you think about it.
I did feel the article, as you know, as we go through it, as you kind of get to the top 3 points, it kind of loses its way a little bit. But one thing it reminded me of is, you know, in retro games, you know, sometimes the game is just sucks, but sometimes when you go back and play these classic games, it is because you sucked, because the controls are that tight in the game, and the game is tough, but they give you such tight, precise controls, when you do miss a jump, like in games like, you know, Contra for the NES and stuff like that, it is actually down on you. Whereas I think what they're trying to say is a lot of games are very forgiving these days, and we kind of lose how tight controls had to kind of be on like those like action platformers and stuff back in the day.
But being able to also save states or just save as you are. Like, I remember getting to a checkpoint would be hard, and a checkpoint, they would ramp up the hardness on like the last jump before you got to that checkpoint or something. So it would be a challenge to get to the next one, and you work through it that way. And I think that's kind of gone a bit.
And I think, yeah, if you're talking about making a game that's kind of a retro themed video game, that was a big part of it back then, you know, platformers actually reaching a checkpoint. And, you know, not having kind of saves every 5 minutes and you can just go back a couple of minutes, which is more of a modern gaming thing. I must admit, I am a fan of like Infinite Continues. I think those are kind of, I really do need probably at least 50 continues in a difficult platformer these days to not just give up on it.
You've lost your skills, worse. Dan.
Oh, I never had the skills. What I used to do is, you know, I'd die and then I'd give up on that game now. That's why I very rarely finish games as a kid. I can probably count on one hand the amount of video games I finish in my life.
Oh, wow. That's disappointing.
Yeah, there's not many. Yeah, I'm not a skilled guy. That's why I talk about them. I don't play them. The next one is retro music is not computer music. Kind of following on from the graphics one, he's saying, you know, retro music's not just about beeps and boops. Actually, there was games back in the day that had full orchestras in there, stuff like, you know, The Seventh Guest and stuff like that. So he's saying, but really, I mean, that's kind of modern games. Have got that kind of
I still remember the GTA rap, every single lyric.
He's saying retro has good graphics as well. Again, he's talking about games like Monkey Island 2 that, again, wasn't just pixel art. He's saying story and lore still played a big part. This is something I probably agree with, that the fact that a lot of retro games are very simplistic, but, you know, going back to games like, for example, he mentions I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, which was, you know, a very, very heavily story-based game. And a lot of those point-and-click adventures that you talked about before, they're not just simplistic arcade blasters, so, like a lot of retro
games. But some were awful as well. So like Banshee, I think it's like someone comes down to steal the plans for the microwave oven, aliens do, or something like that. It's all based around the microwave. And yeah, just like you can tell some stories were just slapped onto old retro games to kind of justify it, and especially licensed games as well.
Oh yeah, I mean, a lot of them like started life as other games, didn't they? They just slapped the license on and changed the graphics slightly. This one, I've got to say, is something that always bugged me as an adventure game player as a kid. Puzzles didn't always make sense. So particularly in point and click games, I mean, he mentions Myst in the article that did have very difficult puzzles, but they were quite logical. You know, when you figured it out, you felt a sense of achievement. A lot of those point-and-click adventure games just had puzzles that were so bizarre, I couldn't figure them out until I got, like, a walkthrough in a magazine, for example.
Yeah, that is a hard one, because it's like, I was recently playing through Silent Hill, and some of the puzzles really, really baffled me, whereas I've not had that issue with any sort of modern kind of survival horror puzzle games. I've not had to, you know, go online and look at a quick YouTube video on how to do it, because I've given up after 5 minutes. You know, I've managed to get through them. So, you know, him saying puzzles didn't make sense, they, like you say, they did make sense once you got through them, but I feel like they definitely were harder back then. But maybe it was just because we didn't have the internet.
Yeah, I always wonder if some of them were actually made to kind of get, you know, more calls to game tip lines, you know, like the Nintendo helpline, that kind of thing. Because obviously, if there's a really logical puzzle in there, you'd have to spend your, you know, Be on the phone for like 5 minutes, spending 50p a minute calling up these game tip lines back then.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. I didn't think of that.
There could be the cynic in me. And then he finishes up just by saying, you know, simplicity is better. And he's right in many ways. Games like Tetris, you know, that have stood the test of time and are still playable to this day. Really, the games that you go back to over and over again are the ones that were just, you know, pure addictive fun and didn't try to overcomplicate things. So it would be great. I mean, this probably is like another Tetris game in the pipeline somewhere that'll come out and be really simplistic, but the entire world will fall in love with it. You look at games like Candy Crush, for example. You know, games like that that come along.
Flappy Bird.
Flappy Bird. There is a website, and I think I linked you guys to this the other day. I think it's called PlayCanvas.com.
That's why I mentioned it.
And Flappy, because I mean, do you remember the story of Flappy Bird when that came out? Probably about 5-6 years, maybe even longer ago, maybe a decade ago now. I remember the guy who made it. He didn't want it to be as popular as it was, and he kind of deleted it from all the app stores and everything.
Yeah, he got overwhelmed with the fame, I think.
Yeah.
But it does actually lead well onto our next story, Flappy Birds.
Yeah, if you want to check out that full list of 10 things modern retro games get wrong, you'll find that in our show notes as well. Something you might not need help with because, well, then again, I don't know, I haven't been playing this much. Ravi spent most of the afternoon on this, is Jennifer Lopez's new 8-bit game that you can play in your web browser.
Yeah, so this is, you know what this is? This is proof that brands kind of see retro as something cool and something that's going to hit with the youth and bring them in. And they've created a Jennifer Lopez kind of browser-based retro game. And also Gucci have been doing one. So there's an official Gucci arcade with great games that I know Dan would love, like Gucci Mascara Hunt.
Oh, I'm straight up.
Would be a great one, yeah. Gucci,
rest of my night sorted.
Yeah, Gucci Ladybugs and stuff. But this J-Lo game is pretty interesting. It's like Flappy Bird, so you kind of, it's three levels, you know, it's just a fun little thing. But you you control J-Lo herself running through the block and collecting designer goods. I don't know why they're all scattered all over the block. And
because Jenny's from the block.
Jenny's
obviously
from the block, but has someone been like dumping designer goods everywhere from the back of the van in the block? And it plays J-Lo music, and then it's got like samples of her. Like it's got chiptune versions of her songs. It's got samples of her like, you can do it, keep going and stuff. And then at the end, like no matter what score you kind of get, she's like, you did fabulously. And then it leads you to the shoe store. But I think it's interesting to have these kind of retro games put on the front of a store or the front of a kind of way of getting someone drawn in or sucked into a brand.
And this is called it's J-Lo Hit Play is the name of the game. And graphically, again, it's kind of like we were talking about a moment ago, it's a retro inspired modern game. A lot of pixel art in here. Like you said, all the music's kind of 8-bit sounding as well, kind of versions of her classic songs. It is interesting that they've gone down this approach, though, and it just kind of proves, I mean, we mention it all the time, how retro, I mean, especially when you get someone who, you know, like a fashion icon like Jennifer Lopez and brands like, you know, Gucci working on retro games and stuff as well, it really does prove how much it's become mainstream. I mean, you couldn't imagine something like this 10 years ago. Retro games, they would have seemed really naff to that audience, you'd imagine.
Yeah, yeah. They would have been seen as geeky and uncool, and it still is. Yeah. You know, to a very, you know, large market of people. But
and look at us guys.
You want to look at us guys, yeah. But I think Ravi hit the nail on the head there. You know, it's appealing to a lot of younger fans now. You know, as like, it's cool and hip.
And she's got a weird, like, history, J-Lo, with video games. So apparently, like, Kevin Smith, the director, actually gave her a game, a one-off game, on her engagement to Ben Affleck in 2020. Where she stars, really? She stars in it, and she has to kick her way through enemies in order to rescue Ben Affleck, her fiance at the time. So, I'd love to see that leaked.
So was this like a game made just for her?
Yeah, one off by Kevin Smith, where she
we'll have to get her on the show and ask her about it.
Yeah, beating people up to try and get to her fiance at the time. Yeah, Ben Affleck. I don't know.
This is. I'm looking that up. That is called Jen Saves Ben.
Yeah. Wow.
Like, what are these Jennifer Lopez games coming out? Do you think she's going to have like a console coming out soon, like Soldier Boy?
I'm just waiting for Jen Saves Ben to be graded by Water Games and suddenly sell for like 5 million on eBay.
The only copy around.
So yeah, very cool. If you want to play the game, Ravi spent far too long on it this afternoon. So take it, it's quite an addictive game.
No, it's only three levels, but I was just trying to see if I get the maximum score, does she say anything different? And she doesn't.
It's an addictive game. We'll link that up and everything else we talk about at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into this week's interview, getting some incredible stories from companies like Probe, Acclaim, porting arcade games to home systems with the legendary Joe Bonner. He's coming up on the show in just a minute. Let's give a massive thank you to another big supporter of the Retro Hour podcast. And of course, this is our mates at Bitmap Books, who've supported this show, I mean, for many years now, but actually every episode for almost a year, which is just outstanding. You know, we really appreciate their support. And they do such incredible books as well. Now, one that we mentioned at the top of the show was their official Sega Master System Visual Compendium book, which I know you've got a copy within arm's reach, Joe.
I do have a copy because this was my Christmas present from Dan. God, a good couple of years ago now, way before they sponsored a Dan Pick.
So he didn't get it cheap. And then
so he didn't get it. Yeah.
No. Full price, baby.
Full price, baby. Yeah, this is the Sega Master System Visual Compendium, which I absolutely love. You've got over 400 pages here all about Sega Master System with, I think, about 200 games covered in here as well with all the pixel art, and it looks absolutely beautiful. And also, as I've said before, I'm a simple guy. I like simple things. I really like this one because it's actually got a 3D section in the middle, and it comes with some Sega 3D glasses. So you can, you know, because the Master System actually had some 3D games where you could switch it on and off. You can actually...
I was with Ravi when he played that and almost puked at one of the play expos we went through.
You can actually look at those games with the glasses on, which is absolutely awesome. And these books are really, really, really good presents for any retro gamer.
Yeah, and they've got, I mean, you look at the way that those books are presented as well, you know, really vibrant colours. They've got, as we mentioned before, it's a luxurious feel
absolutely.
To those books, isn't it? When you've got that new shelf at your coffee table and you've got that varnished cover on there as well. Give the book a little knock. Let's see how the quality. Oh.
There you go. It's like knocking on a door.
So if you're a fan of the Sega Master System, you've got to check that book out. And actually, if you want to check it out, maybe treat yourself before Christmas, I've actually reduced the price of the book by £5. So this is a special offer that's running until the end of November. And also you get a free PDF if you purchase it direct from Bitmap Books as well. Obviously 400 plus pages, as you mentioned. So you can get it now for just $24.99. So why don't you treat yourself and check out their full range of retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.co.uk. Now let's take a moment to give a huge thank you to our incredible patrons who, of course, keep this podcast coming out week in, week out. Let's give a big shout out to our latest patrons, our good friend Luke Yeendel, who supported the show.
Joe Pally.
Jason Efferidge.
And Richard Helling, who all came on board over the last couple of weeks. And, of course, we do have many perks for our patrons as well. Now we're going to be doing our monthly patrons hangout this coming Sunday, which I don't know about you guys, that is always like the Sunday of the month that I look forward to when we do the hangout.
Yeah, man, absolutely. My wallet doesn't look forward to it because of we always end up having a chat about all the new stuff that's out, and we kind of show off, you know, all the things we've been buying recently, and I always get a little bit jealous.
I need one of them.
Yeah, exactly. But as Ravi's pointed out before, it's just like a real community feel to it, you know. It's not like everybody comes on and it's like, oh, it's Joe, Dan and Ravi, like, let's ask them questions or anything like that. We kind of just sit back and all just hang out, don't we? Which is really cool.
No one cares about us.
Yeah, exactly. It's the community part of it.
Which is why we love it. I mean, you know, it is great fun, especially we had a bunch of new faces on last month as well. If you'd like to join us, we're going to be doing it on a Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Before that, we're going to be recording the latest episode of our patrons' exclusive podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours. Now, our alternate episodes... We did the PlayStation special last month, are all about specific years in gaming. And actually, we're going a bit out of sync because we did 99, 2000, 2001, 2002. We're actually going to go back and do 1998 now, aren't we? Just to swap it up a little bit.
Yeah. I remember 1998. I was fully PlayStationing then. And some awesome titles out back then. And, Tekken 3. And you'd force your friend. Nobody could play Eddie Gordo. Because that's just complete cheating. And I really love that kind of period of gaming, and I've got to try and look through and get my memories all sorted, because we've been going all over the different years. I'm getting a bit mixed up with what's going on.
Well, I mean, even in terms of computers as well, that year with stuff like, you know, the Microsoft trial, you know, when Netscape versus Microsoft and that all kicked off, you know, the Bill Gates infamous case.
Oh, I can talk about that for hours.
AOL buying Netscape, Apple introducing the first iMac, Windows 98 came out in that era as well. Loads of games to talk about. I mean, it's going to be a really interesting one to chat about, I think. So we'll no doubt do an hour or two on that as we obviously, the year 2000 bug, we start to talk about that in 1998 as well. So if you want to join us, jumping in the DeLorean back to 1998, you can check out our latest patrons exclusive podcast that we're recording this weekend too. And you can watch episode 300 of this show that we're going to be doing on Halloween. How's about that for tempting fate?
I'm not going to dress up, but what we're going
to... Oh, we've got
what,
it. We've got it.
What we're going to do is, I might just put a pumpkin on my head. we're going to set up a camera in the studio. So you'll be like a fly on the wall, and you can kind of watch warts and all, and watch us how we record the show and everything. And you know, it should be good fun because we've not seen each other for years. And I think Dan's going to be dressed up as a Ghostbuster probably or something.
I just normally do anyway.
I was going to say, that's just standard Sunday.
Vacuuming with a proton pack.
But also, I mean, we're going to try and get our patrons involved, hopefully get a few of you on the show as well. So it's going to be a real giggle. And of course, everyone else can watch the first video version of this show. I'll say first, maybe the last as well, depending on how it goes. And lots of our mates are going to be coming on as well. It's going to be a real celebration of the podcast. Hopefully you can join us for that. And if you want to take part in it live, give us all back on Patreon. All patrons are going to be welcome to that, every tier. So all the details on that are on our website at theretrohour.com. Right then, I'm going to kick back and enjoy this incredible interview that you guys have done. So many stories about classic games, probe, acclaim, arcade titles getting ported to the home with this week's special guest, Joe Bonner. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to the Retro Hour, and we're here today with Joe Bonner. How are you doing, Joe? And you have an interesting story behind your name, don't you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for asking. I'm here in beautiful British Columbia, in North Vancouver specifically, looking out the windows at my at the trees that are in the ravine behind my house, which is lovely. Yeah, my real name is actually Jonathan, and as a kid, my parents used to call me Jonathan Joe, just like the A.A. Milne poem. Jonathan Joe has a mouth like an O and a wheelbarrow full of surprises. I won't say the rest of it. and the weird thing is the Jonathan bit just kind of tailed off and the Joe bit stuck. So everybody just called me Joe. And when we were working with Electronic Arts on FIFA 96, or it might have been FIFA 95, they insisted that we got email, and I actually added the E to my name. So instead of just J-O, it would become J-O-E, so that people didn't think that I was Joanne. And the E just stuck. So I became a regular Joe with an E. And that was, I don't know, however many decades ago 1995 was.
Well, I was going to say... You know, you're in Vancouver, but you've got that British accent. So you must have been raised there. And what was your kind of first gaming experience then in England?
Yeah, so I was in England for the first 30 years of my life, and my accent is just not going to go away. And also, when I talk to people from Britain, my accent comes back again. I was born in South Croydon. South Croydon, mate. You can take the boy out of South Croydon, but apparently you can't take his accent away from him. So the question was, what was my first gaming experience? It was playing Space War on my dad's mainframe computer at his work. Oh, wow. I think it was Space War. It was basically like you would have an ASCII grid, and it was like Star Trek. And, you know, you would go and you would attack the enemies. I don't know whether they were called Klingons, but it was probably not called that. But I used to absolutely look forward so much to playing on, you know, this computer. They called it Albert, and it had its own air-conditioned room. You know, it was a big thing, and it was that classic mainframe, you know, with the flashing lights and loading on those big cylindrical hard drives that were like, you know, 4K hard drives that were bigger than your head. But yeah, that got me into it to start with. So that was, you know, a black screen with the green or the orange writing on it.
So now I'm interested to, you know, to find out what did your dad do with that? What did your dad do for a living?
So he was an entrepreneur, and he owned a number of car dealerships.
Okay.
He was the first person to import Toyotas into the UK.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he put the deal together with, you know, the folks over in Toyota. I remember he went to Japan. So going to Japan in the 70s, I guess, was really different from going to Japan now. I have some stories about not going to Japan, by the way, which I could share. I asked him to bring me back a kite, like a Japanese kite, you know, with like a fighting warrior face on it. And he did. So we met him at the airport and he brought me back that kite. So, yeah, he used that to essentially run the business. Not the kite, the mainframe.
The mainframe.
Were they pretty crazy, those kites? I remember people like, I think they said they put like glass on the wires and stuff, and they'd try.
I've seen fighting kites. Now this one was probably, I don't know, I was small, so it felt like it was big. It was probably 2 feet by 3 feet, and it was a square made of bamboo with the paper stretched over it, and then hand painted like that classic angry looking Japanese warrior face on it.
So after Space War, what was your kind of, how did you kind of get into gaming? What are your memories after that? So we've got Albert. What was next? You know, was it the 2600? ZX81.
So ZX81, 1K, 1K chess. And then we got the 16K RAM pack. And it allowed me to run the two games that I remember most, 3D Monster Maze and 3D Defender. Those were on constant rotation. And we used to, I'm doing air quotes here that you can't see. We used to cheat on 3D Monster Maze by turning up the volume on the TV, because there was feedback from the processor or feedback from the video generating hardware that made a noise when the processor was working harder. And we knew that the monster was nearby when the processor was working harder. So, you know, it would like be reasonably quiet, but then it would like go bzz, 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 like that. And you'd be like, the monster's nearby. I don't know whether it was cheating or whether it was a feature. Let's just say it was a feature.
It's like a mini map, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little noise mini map. And then after that, Spectrum, and the games that I played on that, Jetpack and Pust. Is it pronounced Pust or is it literally just Pst? And then after that, the C64.
One question, we've had so many people talk about the wobbly RAM pack. What was your method of keeping the RAM pack in there? We've had people like cutting it to pieces. BlueTac was one.
Yeah, BlueTac.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, it was BlueTac. I probably would have shuddered at the thought of cutting it in any way, because one of the notes that I made is I absolutely love the industrial design of those devices. Like the ZX81 with its stupid membrane keyboard, it was still just a beautiful piece of hardware. The Spectrum, I would love to have a decent example of a Spectrum just to have that beautiful, colorful chiclet keys. It was lovely. The thought of cutting it in any way to make it work better terrifies me.
I bet there's not many in Canada as well.
There are not. I think Timex had it in North America, so it would be a Timex Spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah. My brother sent me a ZX81, which I still have in the basement.
Nice. Well, what kind of titles really stood out to you and influenced you, especially on like the C64?
So on the C64, the game that I remember playing the most, Forbidden Forest and Aztec Challenge. I think Aztec Challenge and Forbidden Forest were the two games that I played first on the Commodore 64. And I played those a lot, because when the games are scarce, you play them more. Mm. So, you know, I had two games. So I played those two games over and over and over. And I remember having like a little telly, and it might have been a black and white telly to start with, a little black and white telly in my bedroom and the Commodore 64 and the tape drive. And, you know, just playing those over and over again. Impossible Mission was another game that, you know, came up eventually. And hearing that voice sample, you know, samples are ubiquitous now, but back then, insane.
And they stick with you for life.
They really do. And, you know, the weird thing is, and this is just a little bit sad, is I got the C64. I bought one. And I was really, really excited to play all of the games. And literally, you know, you can get all of the games. You can download them all. And you can download original titles. And the original titles were more fun, because those memories now, they're 30 years old.
Mm.
And things have moved on. So it wasn't as much fun to replay Impossible Mission as it was to play it the first time, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, it does lose it, doesn't it? You can't have those rose-coloured glasses on, and then you sit down and play it, and it's not quite as nostalgic as you hoped.
Yeah.
So at what point did you start thinking, right, you know, I want to start programming. these kind of games. You know, I want to get into programming them. I want to make my own games. I want to get into the background of computing. When did that kind of happen, and what made that happen?
Well, I think it was immediate. I think with the ZX81, I wanted to program it, and my friend Jonathan Hayward, he got me into programming, starting on BASIC on the Spectrum. I remember, you know, we were in his bedroom. We were, like, literally, we were those bedroom coders.
Yeah.
And he was teaching me to program in BASIC, and, he was teaching me about the variables and stuff. And we made each line, 10 more than the next. It was 10, 20, 30, 40. And I said, why do we do this? And this, it's so weird that these memories stick with you. And he said, so in case you need to, you can put more lines in between. You know, if you need to put a line 11 or a 12 in or a 15 or whatever, you can. And I remember saying to him, why can't you just put decimal points? Why can't you have, line 10.1? And he said, well, why don't you try it? And then the Spectrum just went syntax error. And I'm like, okay, it doesn't work. But, that was a memory that stuck with me for, I guess, 30-something years, 35 years maybe. The thing that really pushed me into it was CompuNet and the C64 demo scene. So seeing all of these crazy demos just made me think, okay, I want to make these. And then I learned assembly language. And that sort of got me started. And then the way everybody learns, at least I think the way everybody learns, is to look at other people's code and see how it does it. So Sodan's side borders, you looked at his code and you see how he controlled the interrupts to, switch off the border and then switch it back on again. We would take that and see how that worked, and then we would see what we could do to expand it to the whole screen, and then multiplexing sprites, all that kind of stuff. It was the C64 demo scene that really got me going.
So you were kind of BBSing back then as well, and getting a lot of these demos. And do you remember any of the groups, and do you remember any kind of massively influential demos for you?
Oh, goodness me. I honestly don't. They seem to remember me more than I remember them, but that's the classic thing, right? It's like, I'm just one person and they're a whole group of people. So I went under the name G.I. Joe, except I didn't have an E at the end. So I was just like the letter G, the letter I, and then a dash, and then J-O. And I don't think I was very prolific. They were all just experiments to me. It was like, let's see how many sprites we can get on the screen, or let's see if we can make a massive full screen scrolling text or bouncy text or whatever. And I would take graphics that I made, or I would take other people's graphics, and I would sort of showcase, crikey, I can't remember the guy's first name, Whitaker. I would showcase his music.
David Whitaker.
Yeah, David Whitaker. I would just take a piece of his music and then play that. Or I would take a piece of Rob Hubbard music and take that and just, play that. And it was weird because you didn't really have to ask for permission at the time. And you would often get good feedback. It's like, oh, yeah, thanks for sharing my art, or thanks for, sharing my music. I don't remember anybody ever getting pissed off about it, but they might have done.
How times have changed.
Yeah.
So you studied computer science at East Surrey College a little bit later. Was that course a good foundation for entering the video game industry, or, did it help you? Did you learn a lot, or, kind of like bedroom programming, was that better for you?
Yeah, the answers are sort of yes, no, yes, no, and yes.
Yeah.
My parents insisted that I went to college and, got some kind of certification, because there was no way that, what I had done or what I had learned or taught myself was going to stand me in any good stead at all. It was fun. It was useful. It taught me some discipline that I probably didn't have. I met my wife at East Surrey College. So two virtual thumbs up for that, definitely. Some interesting stories, though. We learned a bunch of different languages. So we learned how to do, COBOL and Fortran and Pascal. And they were teaching us assembly language. And I remember just the teacher was talking about how to do multiplications in assembly language. What the instructor said is, you create a for next loop for the number of multiplications that you want to do. And I'm just like, here's a much more efficient way of doing it. And, I would talk about bit shifts and stuff like that. And I was just a butthead, and that was not okay. But at the same time, it's like, you're teaching these people the wrong thing. And I also remember learning about C, and curly brackets are ridiculous and this is stupid. And it turned out that C was, you know, the language of the future. So back in 1980 something, we were being taught stuff, and I was too confident that assembly language was what needed to be done, because you could talk directly to the computer using it and you don't need any obfuscation or compilation. Yeah, wrong.
We've had so many people on the podcast that have talked about courses and how they were totally not relevant to getting in the video game world, even though they were kind of computer based. But it sounds like East Surrey College had a bit of look forward, you know, with C.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was good. It was fun, and it was the right thing to do at the time. I created back then a multi-user online chat system on their Prime mainframe. And what it would do, it would open the file, and then while the file was being used, any number of people could queue up their chats, and it would make sure that the chats appeared in the right order. So, you know, somebody would say, I don't know, hi, good morning, and then people would reply, but it would make sure that their place was correct, because only one person could have a file open at the time. Anyway, we used it to share answers in our exam. And of course, me being stupid and ignorant and so absolutely sure of myself, it didn't occur to me for 1 minute that there would be any logs going on at all. So yeah, I got hauled in front of the principal's office and told off for cheating in the exam. I got suspended for 2 weeks. But I think they probably used that chat software for a while afterwards. But yeah, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that I didn't think that they would just be logging absolutely everything.
Organizing mass cheating. Well, how did you go from that to getting involved with Telecomsoft then?
I went to the computer fairs, and you know, my parents were super supportive, and it wasn't actually business cards. It was those stickers that you stick on envelopes, you know, like for the return address.
The little ones on the back, the square
one. Yeah. And it was like, you know, Joe Bonner, JB16 on CompuNet, and here's my phone number. And I went to a computer show and I gave them to everybody. You know, I gave them to literally everybody. I remember giving them to, you know, Jeff Minter, all the guys from Zap and Crash Magazine, and you know, the guys from Rainbird and Telecomsoft, and I don't know, MicroPose maybe. I don't know who was necessarily there, but I did give one to Colin Fuich over at Telecomsoft, and he gave me a call shortly afterwards and said, you know, I'm looking for an assistant. Do you want a job? And I'm like, yes, I do. What is it? Yoza Hughes, is it? Give us a job. I can do that. Give us a job. I was that guy. At the show.
So you first designed BMX on the C64. What was the process like converting that to Amstrad and Spectrum? And was it tough to kind of like choose which features to cut down and scale down and just completely cut from the game?
Yeah, I think we ended up just scaling down the screen until it was just a tiny square in the middle in the middle of the Spectrum and Amstrad screens. I remember that particularly. I can see I'm really, really good with faces. And voices, I can see and hear the guy who did the conversions. And I want to say his name was Stefan, but I can't remember exactly. I could probably go back and check the credits, because people are kind enough to keep the credits, you know, up to date on stuff like that. He was amazing. And I think it might have been his first gig. And, you know, what we did is we just tried to put as much in as we possibly could, knowing that we were going to be shifting the screen using software, and we were trying to make it as quick as possible. So it was like, let's just try and get everything in, and whatever we can't get in, we can either find a way to compromise it in or remove it without messing too much with the game. I still remember on the Commodore 64 writing 6.5K of code that controlled the bikes and didn't actually output anything on the screen. You would put a set of numbers in, and then 6.5K later, these numbers would come out the other side. That was like 10% of the entire C64 memory was used for this. Blew my mind at the time. I don't think you can get an icon that is, you know, less than...
Or even like a text document.
Yeah. It's mad. Absolutely mad. So the answer to that is not... I don't think that it was diligent and deliberate. It was like, okay, mate, what can we get done? Okay, here's the scrolling, here's the bikes. Let's just say it was agile development before agile was even a thing. There you go. I can't claim that it was. It just seems like it was.
Well, Telecomsoft was like split into different labels. There was like Firebird, Rainbird, and Silverbird. Which bird were you in?
I started out at Firebird, which was kind of a catch-all. So it was initially Firebird and Rainbird. So Firebird was the budget, and then Rainbird was the sort of higher end. So you would get, oh my goodness me, Carrier Command might be a Rainbird title, or Elite might be a Rainbird title, although I think it went out on Firebird, not exactly sure. So Firebird was budget and Rainbird was the posh one. But then a new marketing person came in whose name I can see, but I can't read it. If that makes sense, it's in my head. Debbie Silito. There you go. I knew I could get it in the end. And she split off Silverbird, which became the budget label. And Firebird was, you know, a bit more posh. And then Rainbird stayed posh. So Silverbird was $1.99. I think Firebird might have been $2.99, slightly higher value products. And then Rainbird was, $9.99 or more. So one of the things I found out about myself is I have aphantasia, which means I can't see. I don't have a mind's eye, which really weirds me out because I always thought I did. You know, if somebody says, can you imagine an apple? The answer is yes, I can imagine an apple. I can't see it, but I can imagine it. And I could see Debbie Silito's name in my head, but I couldn't quite read it. It just took me a little bit more to refer to it. Sorry, that's a really long answer, isn't it?
But no, it got me thinking then as well. I was like, can I see an apple? I was like, I can see an apple.
Yeah, I literally can't. I thought it was normal.
And isn't it funny, like when we're going off topic here, but I only found out a few years ago that not everybody thinks the same, and some people literally don't have a mind's voice and don't think before they speak. And I didn't realize that was a thing until...
Blimey, neither did I.
Yeah, and there's a word for that as well. I forget the word. There's a posh word for that. People who don't have like an inner monologue and talk to themselves. I just thought, you know, everybody talks to themselves in their head when they're thinking. But yeah, interesting.
I hum and sing songs.
Yeah, I've got like drum and bass in my head all the time.
So our next question is North and South, massive game, iconic title. How was it developing, you know, on that game? It's such a mix of action with huge battles and, you know, then platforming sections and stuff like that. What was that like?
I wish I had an exciting answer for you. We were given the source code and all of the source art. We diligently transposed it. We diligently converted it from, I think it was probably the Amiga or the ST, onto the C64. That was done by legendary programmer Darryl Bowers. And I remember specifically, we would sleep at the office to get North and South done. And I remember duvets underneath the desks. I remember a Commodore 64 power supply getting tangled up in a duvet and then melting and almost causing a fire. I remember getting locked out of the office and us going behind the office and noting that the window of the third floor at Tamworth Road, the probe office at Tamworth Road, was open. And then us trying, well, when I say us, I mean Daryl, climbing up a flagpole that was behind the office to see whether we could get into the office. Because, I mean, we went out to get a kebab or something. You know, It was like the middle of the night and the kebab shops are open. Went out to get a kebab, the door locked, and we couldn't get back in again. And then I remember the flagpole breaking with him, you know, a good two-thirds of the way up it. And then doing that thing where the flagpole is falling down and he's hanging onto it. And then, you know, he hits the ground with a thump. And so those are my memories of North and South. Not
that,
about
that
the
sounds
game.
Like not about something the from North and South.
Kebabs and getting locked out of buildings.
Yeah, you know, the actual process is, you know, somewhat lost in the mist of time. I expect if you were to ask Daryl about it, you know, it would be, it was a slog. It was definitely a slog because they didn't give us long to do it. Because I remember they gave us North and South because we did such a good job on Bobo, which was like another French cartoon comic character. He was like a prisoner. I remember, because this was Infogrames, wasn't it? This was Infogrames before it became, I guess, Eidos now. Yeah, I think so. I remember working with a guy called Philippe Agrippinidis on these things. I don't know where he is now, but I think we might still be friends on LinkedIn. So yeah, sorry, I can't give you many specifics other than they gave us the source code and the source art, and we fit it into the C64 by hook or by crook and by climbing flagpoles after eating doner kebabs.
I think it was massively impressive that it kind of ran on the C64, but also like that whole battle scene genre. Do you remember like playing kind of Total War series later on and kind of getting a bit like flashbacks of North and South?
Yeah, I get flashbacks of all sorts of games that I've worked on. Yeah, it's funny. I tried so hard to get into sort of the big turn-based strategy stuff, or, you know, even the real-time strategy stuff. And I have a lot of RTS games in my collection. I still follow the antics of the folks who made Homeworld. Darn it, they were across the way from us. Blackbird Interactive? Or at least they became Blackbird Interactive.
Was so that the space one, Homeworld?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was epic. Great game.
It was. The thing that annoyed me about Homeworld, and look at me, I'm going off a tangent again, is that you could get to a point where something that you should have done six levels ago affects your ability to do what you need to do now. And that was really irritating. But the thing about Homeworld is it really was a space opera. And I absolutely loved the voice of Karen Sajet, the voice of the computer. Turns out that was the receptionist at the company. And, you know, they recorded her, and that's what sort of kept me in the game. Weird. Anyway, sorry, RTSs. I never really stayed in them. I certainly tried. And I still have quite a few RTSs and also turn-based strategy games, but I don't play them much.
So around that time, obviously a lot of games you were kind of involved in working on, but one that's really stood out for me, what I wanted to ask you about, was Golden Axe. What was your kind of involvement in porting Golden Axe? You know, how involved in that were you? You know, and were you familiar with the arcade game and, you know, kind of like making sure that when it got ported that it still had that feel to it?
Oh, God, was I familiar with the arcade game? Yes. This was probably at the time where the arcade companies, I think it was Sega, they didn't realize that it would make the game so much better if they gave us the source code and the source art. They were still very, very protective of it. So we would set up a video camera over the shoulder of somebody playing it, and that would be David Shea, who was the programmer, me, ZZKJ, Zachary Zoltan Johannes, because he did the Amiga versions, I'm pretty sure he did. Legendary programmers, like absolutely legendary. But we would play the arcade game on free play with a video camera over our shoulders over and over and over and over again. And we would literally break down the animations. You know, it was hard to do screen caps.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we even did screen caps, but the amount of labor that actually went into it was shocking, really.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
extraordinary, because it was like, you know, what happens when these characters are right next to each other or X number of pixels apart or X number of pixels apart. And the other thing that I remember specifically about Golden Axe on, I'm pretty sure we did it for the Spectrum and the Amstrad and maybe the C64. Those were character-based animations. And, you know, so we had to put effort into making it right on the Spectrum and the Amstrad, the C64. And then we had to make it right on the Amiga, on the ST and the PC and on all of the other formats. But, you know, it was by pure force of expenditure of time and energy.
Yeah.
There was so much more efficient ways to do it. And we got there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were other companies that eventually, you know, would give us source code and source graphics, like Mortal Kombat. We got all of the source art.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was a lot of work. And trying to maintain the arcade feel, it was literally done. The engineers would do their best to make the game feel right. And then you would play it and you would be, because you had this muscle memory from playing the game so much, you knew how it felt, whether it felt right. It's like, this needs to be a bit faster. This arc, jump arc needs to be a bit better, you know, X, Y, and Z.
And you know, I've got visions right now. You're just constantly watching videotapes of somebody playing, you know, on this arcade machine, just hammering it, just rewinding it, and just trying to count the pixels on a TV screen, looking at an arcade machine just to get it pixel perfect. But, you know, I wonder, did Sega at least send you an arcade machine, or did you have to get a hold of one yourself?
No, they sent us an arcade
machine. Oh, at least they did that.
Yeah, they
you went down the local arcade.
Yeah, they might have sent us more than one. Yeah, I also remember Mr. Helly, Jim Bagley, who did Mr. Helly. He literally copied the game from the videotape.
Times have definitely changed there.
Yeah, he's actually just done Dragon's Lair for the Spectrum, crazily doing kind of the copying as well, which is just mad. Yeah,
my buddies over at Code Mystics, Jeff Vavasor and George and Peter Phillips, or it might have been Mike Micah, I'm not sure. They did it on the Game Boy. They did Dragon's Lair on the Game Boy. Madness.
Well, the Amiga port was really awesome. And like, I think the thing about Probe stuff as well was like the focus on quality with all the different releases, because, you know, sometimes you just get like lazy ports slapped on it and not as many options, or sometimes like limited buttons and stuff like that. But I'd always get my Sega friends around and I'd be like, look at this port. Look, it's Golden Axe. You know, it was something to kind of be proud of as an Amiga user. Was there like a focus on getting the best quality releases for systems there?
Yeah, it really was. Because, you know, they say you're only as good as your last release. So we wanted our games to be good so that people would give us more work. And, you know, eventually we did become a little bit famous for making platform games, but they were quite good platform games and they were consistent platform games. And we did get into a rhythm, which we can talk about a little bit later on. But the other thing that was important is that the producers and the programmers, they loved the games and they loved the hardware. So when there was an opportunity to make it really, really good, then we would. And that just sounds so simple and, you know, well, duh, but that's what drove us is if you could make it great, then go make it great. That's kind of where it all came from, really.
So obviously, you know, you mentioned then, you know, we went on to kind of like getting into the platformers and getting into that rhythm and stuff. Also around this time, you were working on games like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Back to the Future. What was that like? What was the experience all of a sudden working on these like massive brands? You know, you got these massive huge films and you're working on, you know, the ports of these games and stuff. What was that like, and what was the quality control like?
I remember being offered Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which I think was called Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
Yeah, it was Hero
by
Turtles.
Mirosoft.
Yeah.
And they're like, literally, we need it in 20 minutes.
That explains a lot.
Anything longer than 20 minutes and, you know, it's late.
Yeah.
So we put our A team on that, which was Dave Perry and Nick Brutti. Mm-hmm. And they used the Dandare / Savage engine.
Yeah.
And they created Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And then we approached Trish Sorrell to do the other versions. And I'm hesitating because I think it might have been... Was it the C64 version? And we actually stayed up at Trish's house and we worked out of their house to get that done. And I remember asking the question, can you do it in time? Can you do it in, like, literally it was 4 weeks or 6 weeks, or it was ridiculous because you either hit Christmas or you were done. And Trish said, yes, we can do it on time because it has to be done on time. And I was like, but can you do it on time? It was a little bit late, but it got done and we got it out pretty much for Christmas, and all was well in the end.
You pretty much had the Shiny Entertainment team on it there, didn't
absolutely
you?
Yeah,
yeah, with Dave Perry and Nick Brutti. That's pretty awesome. Those guys could get it done.
Oh yeah, I mean they were incredibly consistent, and I remember I used to visit them a lot at Dave Perry's mum's house in Staines. Nick Brutti used to live across the road, and you know we got a lot of games done with them. You know, they were very, very good at taking an existing engine and making it do something else. So yeah, they were super reliable.
Well, Alien 3 was a huge, like, fantastic title, and I loved it on the Amiga, but I was surprised to see there was a C64 port in 1992. Like, how long were you guys still porting for the C64, and like, how much of a market was there? Was there still?
Oh goodness, I don't remember how much of a market there was. The business model was, will somebody pay us to do it?
Mm.
And, you know, was it financially viable for us to do it? At the time, all of the maths was done on the publisher side. So if they said, you know, we can give you X to make this C64 version, and then we could get it done for X minus Y and, you know, make some profit of it on it, then we would. And I actually recall the name of the engineer who did the C64 version. It was Mike Archer. And we had a lot of fun doing the C64 version because I think, you know, we were fans of the C64 and it was an interesting challenge to do. And because we were using a piece of software written by Carl Muller called CRISP, or it might have been CRISP 2. CRISP stood for Carl's Really Incredibly Strange Program. And it was a tile-based game engine. So if we had the maps on the Genesis or the Mega Drive, we could make them for the C64. If we could have them for the C64, we could put them on the Master System or on the NES. Because there was an NES version of Alien 3 as well, which I don't know whether it ever got published. I'm not sure.
It did.
But we made it for the NES.
Yeah, it did. It did. I was Alien 3 was on everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because at the time, it could be. Because the fundamentals of it meant that we could port it across everything.
And like, I even remember the Amiga port. It didn't have the background music, but every other element was there, and it seemed like the graphics had also been a bit touched up for each system as well. So you guys must have been really having a huge porting operation there, and all of these tools created, and you know, just became really efficient at it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, the joke used to be that people would come to us with a license. It was like, you know, we want to make Alien 3, or we want to make Back to the Future, or we want to make Pagemaster, or Stargate.
Yeah.
And we would say, absolutely, how many platforms would you like? Meaning, how many different kinds of hardware do you want it on?
Yeah.
But also, how many platforms inside the game? Because we just made platform games at the time. It was... That's what we did because it was super, super efficient. So yeah, those games that I named, they all became platform games.
Yeah. And every kind of like version of those games, like you say, I've played multiple versions of Alien 3, Pagemaster as well. I didn't even realize you'd, you know, work with that. But yeah, all of those games, when you think about it, they've all, you know, different assets within the games and different level of graphics and stuff. But yeah, the gameplay is always solid platforming games, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you mentioned, obviously, this isn't a platforming game, I'm guessing a little bit before, or maybe a little bit after, but you mentioned, so we've squeezed it in here, you worked on Mortal Kombat, on the port of Mortal Kombat. What's your memories there?
Very similar memories to Golden Axe. We knew that Mortal Kombat was going to be massively successful. Yeah. We worked our asses off to get it out as quickly as possible on as many formats as we possibly could. I remember specifically that it was Gary Liddon who essentially brokered the deal to get that license. We had a Mortal Kombat arcade machine in our stairwell at Tamworth Road. So it was at the bottom of this, the our spiral stairs going up, you know, to the second and third floors. And we would play it all the time. But what we did there is I'm 100% sure that they gave us all of the source art. So it was a lot easier for us to take that refined source and then move it down to eventually the Game Boy. There was a Game Boy version of Mortal Kombat.
Yep, I have it.
I might have it too. But we knew it was going to be massively successful. And even now, Ed Boon and Tobias,
John Tobias.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Even now, when I see them at computer shows like E3, they come up to me and they're like, hey, you know, thank you. Thank you for this. And it was a golden ticket too, because we could get into the parties at E3 because we worked on Mortal Kombat and because it was such a massively, let's just say, financially influential game, but it was super fun. Here's a crazy story. The Game Boy version of Mortal Kombat 1 was pretty good. It was pretty good. Mm. When we took on Mortal Kombat 2, because we were bound to after doing a really good job of Mortal Kombat 1, the programmer, Tony Hartley, he looked at the code and he's like, I'm calling the screen update twice. So on Mortal Kombat 2, he only called the screen update once. So it ran twice as quickly as the Mortal Kombat 1 on the Game Boy. There you go. There's a real inside scoop right there.
That's interesting, that is. I was going to say, you know, and this is the thing, you know, the Mortal Kombat on the Game Boy, YouTubers and stuff hate on it, but like you say, it's running on the Game Boy.
Yeah.
There's a lot to cram in there.
But my favorite Game Boy story is when we were doing FIFA 95, or it could have been 96, I can't quite remember, for EA, Kevin Piquel, the lead programmer, got into a motorcycle accident and he couldn't program the game, but we needed to keep up. Kevin Piquel and I still stay in touch because I ended up moving over to Canada to work with EA back in 99. And EA said, you know, Kevin Piquel, our lead programmer, has been involved in a road traffic accident. He's fine, by the way. And they said, what are you going to do about it? And we're like, how do you mean? It's like, we're porting your game. So if your game is not moving on, then there's nothing for us to port, because they would give us the source code every week or every month or whatever, and we'd catch up with it. So anyway, the engineer for the Game Boy version said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to create a cross compiler to take their C code, which was, you know, designed for the PlayStation. I almost said PSX, because that's what we called it in the development circles. He would take their code and write a cross compiler to allow him to stay up to date with the code and actually compile FIFA onto the Game Boy. And we said, this is how it's going to get done. This is the way that we can keep things moving. And while Kevin is recuperating, this is how we can get it done. And, you know, every week it was like, how's it going? And we're like, okay, we're getting there. I don't remember how many weeks it was, but eventually the programmer, whose name I'm racking again, I can see his face. He has round glasses on. He wrote a cross compiler to take their PlayStation code, cross compile it into a language that was then interpreted and then turned into machine language. It only bloody worked. It worked. So we were able to stay on top of the Game Boy development. We would just take their source code and cross-compile it, and it would make the Game Boy version. And I think they used that subsequently for several versions moving forward. It was a freaking miracle. And I just had his name on the tip of my tongue, and it's gone again. But I'll try and remember it. Probably come back.
That's amazing, actually, going straight from PlayStation to Game Boy.
It's extraordinary.
One other title that I was interested in was Constructor, actually, because that was with System 3, and that was a PC title just when kind of 3D rendering was, like, you know, the kind of chubby 3D characters they had on there and like the animations. It was interesting because that was one of the last kind of System 3 games. Why do you think so many companies like fell down during that period and that kind of transition? And what was it like to work on Constructor? Because that was a really quirky, fun game.
It was. So Constructor was devised and invented by Robert O'Farrell, who has gone on to many wonderful things, including, I believe, that he was the producer or executive producer on many of the Harry Potter games. And he's also now very successfully doing those train simulations and farm simulation games. We call him Barg after his D&D character. So really, I just babysat that one because Barg, or Robert O'Farrell, had so much passion for it, as did the owner of System 3 at the time, who you can probably remind me of his name, but I've forgotten it for now.
Mark
Kale.
Kale, that's it, yeah.
Thanks for the prompt.
We've had him on, yeah.
Yeah. They were both very, very passionate about it, and we just made sure that the resources were available. And, you know, I was able to give Rob the benefit of some of my experience for thing X, Y, or Z. But it was primarily driven by the passion that Rob and Mark had for the title. I think it was a very original title. I don't know that, you know, it defined a genre as such, but it was certainly not the kind of thing that had been seen much before. It had a very British humor, I think.
Yeah, it was like Viz or something, wasn't it?
Absolutely it was.
Yeah.
You know, Probe had made Viz. I got some anecdotes about Viz as well. But yeah, you know, it was very British. It was very silly. It was also a very, very well-designed, well-balanced game that just worked ever so well. And I think people now even still play it. You are not the only folks who've mentioned Constructor. You know, I've certainly had some people ask after that, you know, in the past. I might still have a copy of it somewhere for sure. And I bet somebody's made it so that you can, you know, just play it in HTML or something online.
Yeah, there's a remastered Constructor that's actually come out from System 3. So it's like, oh, Constructor HD.
I'm going to have to yeah, check it out.
So around the same time, probably a little bit before, but I really wanted to ask this, you know, because we were talking about Alien 3 and stuff. You were a producer on Alien Trilogy, which, you know, is regarded, you know, to this day, one of the best kind of retro first-person shooters, if not the best Alien game ever made. What was your role there and what was that like working on Alien Trilogy? Did you know you were working on something special at the time?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Alien is still my favorite franchise.
Yeah.
Aliens is still like one of my all-time favorite movies.
Same, sort of there, definitely in the top five.
Absolutely. For me, there's nothing like it. And I've played an awful lot of Alien games and I've had nightmares about Aliens. I really have. I've lived and breathed that universe.
Yeah.
And we knew we were making something special at the time. It was freaking hard.
Yeah.
Because the team had worked on, and this is Mark Fisher. He was the lead engineer at the time. He worked on like the smartest dots in the world. And it was a 2D version of the game.
Okay.
And we were still working on the tools to create the 3D version of the game. The tools eventually were used to create Die Hard Trilogy and Alien Trilogy, which we worked on at the same time.
Such a good game, Die Hard Trilogy.
So Simon Pick is still one of the greatest programmers that I've worked with. I mean, I've worked with a lot of good programmers, and I don't want to detract from any of the excellent talent that I've worked with. But Simon Pick had incredible technical ability and an incredible gameplay ability. He didn't require a lot of supervision on either of those things. Anyway, that engine was used and shared by the Alien Trilogy team. And I remember Mark Fraser. We used to call him Geordie Mark on account of the fact that he was from Newcastle. He came to me and he said, look, you know, we've got these really, really smart dots and we've got this engine over here. We should take this engine over here. It was like Patrick, retroactively. Let's take this engine over here and use it on this game over here, which we did. You know, that gave us the foundation. And I guess the techniques that we used with Crisp, which was like a 2D tile-based toolset and engine, we were able to move over to 3D. So, you know, those backgrounds were largely tiled using some of the similar techniques, if not, you know, 2D versus 3D. Oh, so many stories. Like, I remember storyboarding the intro and having Paul Provenzano over at Acclaim, who had a movie background, saying you don't need to tell the user everything because Acclaim were creating the CG based on our storyboards. And, you know, it was expensive. Mm. It was so much money to do this 3D stuff. And, yeah. we had like three or four Silicon Graphics Indigo machines. That was my first networking experience, by the way. You know, creating the network for the SGIs and using 10BASE-T Ethernet cords and like setting up the DNS. I did not know what the hell I was doing. but once it worked, we had a network with our Silicon Graphics machines on it. I also remember fighting with the motion capture guys over at Acclaim, because they were creating a path that nobody had ever trodden in motion capture. You know, the Acclaim facilities motion capture was like the first motion capture, or one of the first motion capture facilities in the world. And they were most interested in making sure that as the aliens' feet moved, or as the aliens moved, that their feet were stuck on the ground so that they didn't skate. Okay. And I remember, again, I can see his face. I can't remember his name. He would say, how fast are these aliens going to move in the game? And I said, I don't know. They're going to move as fast as they have to for them to be scary, or as slow as they need to in order for them to be stealthy, or whatever feels right. You know, we are going to make the game feel right. And he's like, okay, so do you need us to capture at like 1 meter a second? Do you need to capture us at 30 centimeters a second? I'm like, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter to me, because as you know from playing the game, they're actually 3D models that were pre-rendered into 2D face me sprites.
Yeah. I've been trying to rack my brains, like, did they skate? And I was like, no, they didn't. Like,
they might have done, but it really didn't matter.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, having a protracted conversation. Wes Traeger was the head of motion capture over Acclaim. A protracted conversation about what rate they should move. Mm. And, you know, because he was a tech guy. He was like, I want this to look as good as possible. And I want it to look as good as possible too, but I want it to feel great. It's got to be a fun game first.
Yeah.
And you don't want it to be... I digressed.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I was going to say, you know, it's Alien as well. You know, if we're getting into the nitty gritty, they'd rip you apart if they were too fast. So, you know, you got to turn it down as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We needed the kind of control over the game that having them move at a set pace so that their feet didn't skate, that was not going to give us that. I know you wanted to find out about Bomberman. A little bit of history. I worked with Bob Timbello on Beauty and the Beast for the SNES and the NES for Hudson Soft. And we stayed friends with Hudson Soft. And we ended up being offered a number of titles, one of which was Bomberman. And I have some really, really fond memories of Bomberman from E3, or it might have been CES, where we were playing Bomberman in a cinema on the big screen, and it was a Bomberman tournament, and I think it was one of my first business trips, and I was drunk off my face on Miller Genuine Draft, which was free, and we were having a great time playing this game, and I just grew to love it there and then, you know, fond memories. And then when they offered us Bomberman, it was like, Hell yes, absolutely. And I remember having Hudson Soft come over, and like the creator of Bomberman, whose name I cannot remember, in the boardroom, and he was explaining to us how the controls needed to work, how the collision needed to work, pixel for pixel. He was going through it, and he was beautifully relentless about it. And I remember Steve Jobs said something along the lines of, if you don't understand something that I'm saying, I would just explain it to you better until you understand it. And that's what this guy did. And the thing that we worked with so hard is that you can never stick on a corner. So if you're trying to go around a corner, you cannot stick on it. It has to be smooth. And you know, it took like an hour of detailed explanation to get that across. So it is absolutely pixel perfect, and it works exactly as he wanted it to work. And that was the level of detail we went in on Bomberman, because it is there. Is their precious jewel. It's Hudson Soft's precious jewel. Sure, there are other games that, you know, that they have in their catalog that they love, but Bomberman is the one. And we wanted to have dozens of players, but I think we ended up, I can't remember, was it 8 that we ended up with, or maybe 16?
I want to say 8, because of the Sega Saturn version is famous for being able to have a 10 player. So I feel like it's 8, yeah.
What we wanted to do is we wanted to expand the play area down, you know, so that you could see more and more and more of this play area and like have 64 players and stuff like that. But it wasn't practical at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, if somebody offers you Bomberman, you say yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
And I guess that's why every Bomberman title's been really good, because you've got this guy there kind of saying make it perfect. And
make it perfect in this specific way, and I will continue to explain to you how it needs to be perfect until it is perfect, and we're not done until it's perfect. And that's freaking awesome. Like that's an amazing thing.
That's great. Well, Joe, it's been amazing. And, you know, we've barely touched on stuff like the PlayStation period and the SNES and all of that. So we're going to have to get you back and talk more about it. But I'm sure everybody's going to love this one. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been great. I really appreciated your time.